I don't have a handout. In fact, I don't even have a title. I sort of have a working title, but I don't really have a title because I wanted to be completely open and ready to speak on whatever was here, rather than coming and telling you about something that was someplace else. But I did run through several potential titles. The first one is, What Now? I should say that when Jim and I talked about this, he asked me to come and talk about the real world, the world that you will face once you leave here and go back to your parishes. So the second title I considered is Everything They're Not Going to Tell You About What They're Teaching You at IWS. The third title I considered is Bleeding Edge Worship, and it's going to be your blood. And the last title that I thought I was going to go with was Gird Up Your Loins. But this afternoon when I rewrote this, I decided upon, here's looking at you, kid. And that'll be more clear at the end, and it has something to do with what Daryl said this morning. Now, I'm here as an outside observer, and you could tell that because I'm the only one on campus without a name tag. And I'm here, to a certain extent, as a so-called expert. And you know the definition of an expert. Somebody who's 100 miles or more from home. I live in California, so I'm a big expert at this conference. Okay? So what I decided to do, besides speaking to you today about the real world, is I decided that as long as I was here, I wanted to learn about IWS and what you do. So with Jim's permission, I've kind of poked my nose in places and asked a lot of questions, and I've even been to a faculty meeting. And I want to tell you folks that are students, you have a great faculty. Now, Jim just said that, but I'm the expert because I'm from California. You have a great faculty. And they're great in part because in that faculty meeting, they showed me how much they care about you, not just what you learn, but they care about you. And they care about your ministry. And they care about your own personal burdens. And in academia, you don't find that much. And so I've had a number of conversations, and most of them kind of go this way. I ask questions, and people give me a weird look back. And they wonder if I'm actually real. And in fact, in the last 12 hours, I've been called a fanatic here on campus. I've been called a prophet. And I think that's really kind of weird. It must be because I'm a long ways from home. Because at home, the line that I normally have to use is, what do I know? I'm just a dumb choir director. That was supposed to be a joke. But in the time that I have left here, which is I'm leaving Saturday morning, just call me Vern. And I'm happy to talk to any of you about anything. Because as I said, I have all the answers. Now, one of the things I want to do in kind of a shameless plug for a book that just came out in which I wrote a chapter entitled The Church Musician as Transformational Leader, Can This Church Be Saved? Published by Abington. I'd like to fill in the blanks of my bio because I think credibility is a certain amount of what you're so you can filter what I'm going to say. This is the first sentence of my official bio. Vern Sanders has been a rock musician, a college professor, a jazz pianist, a nonprofit arts foundation administrator, an author, and a music publisher. Well, that was before I retired. And since I've retired, which my family jokes means I went from, and you in bivocational ministry know this, I went from 8 jobs to 5. I've also become a winemaker and a magazine publisher. Now, you probably think that I just can't figure out what I want to do when I grow up. My daughter says I just get bored easily. But I think I just have a whole lot left to learn. And I think God has been very gracious to me to allow me to learn a lot about a lot of things. And what I'm about to say is heresy to you folks. But along about my sophomore year in college, I quit taking notes in class. It's a long background to this, but the short answer is I decided to trust my brain. Because I found if I was taking notes, I wasn't paying attention to what the professor was saying. What happens is that someplace in my brain is information. So if you ask me a question, I will tell you what I know. It might not be right. And I can't, I'm an academic's nightmare because I can't cite footnotes. But somehow or another, I remember what it is that I've learned. I want to tell you a little bit about my church background. My mother was raised in an Episcopalian church. The family never went to church. My father was raised Seventh-day Adventist. He quit going to church because of an event that probably most of you would find very moving as part of worship. It's very meaningful worship. On Maundy Thursday, as a kid, he was involved in a foot washing ceremony. And remember, I'm telling you about the real world. The reason he never went back to church is he got a farmer that hadn't bathed in over a month right out of the field. He never went back to church. So as a little kid, there was an upstairs neighbor, came down and said to my folks, and you don't hear this anymore, at least I don't think so, but she said to my folks, if you don't take that kid to church, I will. And so I grew up Augustana Lutheran, and eventually my mother and my father went to church. I've done professional church, how's that? Since 1957, that's before most of you were born. I have to read this to make sure I get this right. I've gone from being a student accompanist to a section leader to a soloist, and thankfully for that church it was mercifully short time, to a choir director, to a minister of music, to a choir master, to a director of music ministries, to a director of worship. And in the article that I wrote for Creator some time ago that's entitled Music, Ministry, Equal Pay, Pick 2. Think about it. I maintain that my history traces the history of professional musicians in the latter half of the 20th century and into the 21st century. I hear things because I'm in the place I'm in. The fascinating thing about what's happening in the market now, there are two things that are on the horizon that I never would have expected to happen. The first thing is, churches are now going back because of this whole contemporary traditional split service. And can we just do worship? They've gone back to hiring a choir director. And the choir director, that's what they're advertising for now, just a choir director. It's back to the 50s. They want somebody to phone in the anthem, prepare the choir, and show up on Sunday morning. That's it. No pain, no mess, no fuss. The second thing, which I think is actually an incredibly important potential, is that within the last 2 weeks, from two different parts of the country, I have had things come across my desk, specific indications of small churches banding together to hire one musician to do what Bach used to do, which is gather a cadre of people from all these churches who don't have enough to mount a choir or a band. They rehearse in one centralized location and they basically do three services, but the three services are in three different churches. So in the course of my church service, I've been Lutheran, Episcopalian, Anglican, Jewish, Presbyterian, Methodist. I've served one church. Those of you that know Cort Bender, you can ask him. This is an absolutely true story. One of my first jobs in L.A., downtown church, seated 2,900 people. Average attendance was 80. And the average attendance number was less than the average age of the congregation. They took up an entire city block. And I'll never forget being there one December, and upstairs on the third floor where the second chapel was, because it was a city block worth of church, there was a choir rehearsing the Messiah in Samoan. Multiculturalism has been around for longer than we think, longer than we give it credit. Just we white people don't pay attention. This church, 2,900 people, 80 and thing, Methodist church, two blocks this way, three blocks that way, was another church of equal size, equal attendance. And you think they would get together, combine congregations? No, they both died. So why am I here? It comes down to one sentence in one absolutely incredible conversation that happened in about 1983 or 84. I'd left a tenured academic job to take a position to help develop, this is 1983, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the use of arts and worship. We take that for granted. In those days, nobody was doing it. We were traveling around in the early days trying to figure out exactly what to do, and we were interviewing important people. I'll never forget this. We sat across the desk from the then president of the Princeton Seminary, and I'm kind of weird. I read college catalogs, and I read course offerings. I used to do a lot more in those days, but I just found it fascinating what courses are offered. So we're making nice, and I said rather innocently to the president of the Princeton Seminary, I noticed there are no courses in worship. Why is that? Quote, there's no need for worship classes. Our students learn all they need to know about worship by going to chapel. End quote. Now, I say that for two reasons. I bring that to your attention for two reasons. Number one, that was roughly 25 years ago. Every pastor who went through Princeton Seminary and all the rest of the seminaries in the country, that's what they know about worship. If they heard boring worship in chapel, that's their model. If they heard great worship in seminary, in my opinion, sorry, pastors, they didn't know how to recreate it. Second reason I bring it up is you folks here do not realize that you are revolutionaries. For worship, you are the 1960s. And the real world that's out there is rough. That's why I had the title, Bleeding Edge Worship and It's Your Blood. Because I really only want you to remember two things from what I'm saying here. Most of it is just my story. But there's really two things that I want you to remember. One is that almost every mistake I've made in doing worship, doing church, falls into one of two categories. Failure to remember and failure to understand. Now, I know that because I've encountered IWS graduates for many years, it's my honor to be here. And even though it seems like I'm yelling at you, that's just who I am. I don't mean to. I'm sorry. But IWS graduates leave here and they go home with fire not only in their eyes but in their bellies. And that's a good thing. And then they get home. Show of hands. How many of you have been fired yet? How many of you have been fired at least once? Look around. If you haven't been, you will be. Remember what I said. And again, I apologize to all the pastors in this room, but most of the folks in this room are music ministers. And you got here for all the right reasons. You want to bring your congregations into the presence of the living God. That threatens a lot of pastors, particularly if you're good at it. And particularly if you, in your tradition, you're actually on this side of the rail. If you're over here in the traditional choir director pose, I literally have been in churches where people walk up to me and say, "Who are you?" I said, "Wait a minute." And they say, "Oh, I know who you are." A very astute man said to me once that the single biggest change in worship and music ministry over the last 20 years of the 20th century is that we went from face in to face out. Do you understand what I'm saying? The minute that we went from face in to face out, we threatened people. You don't get to be where you are unless you're a strong personality. Well, maybe you do, but I don't think you last very long. And now, you folks are here, and you're taking the equivalent of 4 years worth of worship training with great faculty and great colleagues. You can learn as much from your colleagues as you can from your faculty. And if you don't believe me, ask the upper division classes, the doctoral students. You go back home and you start talking about, I don't know, give me something. What? Say what? Okay. And your pastor says, what? And then you explain how you're going to design this service that's going to change the way that people look at baptism for the next 10 years. And your pastor says, well, I like it just fine. Those of you that have been fired, hold up your hands again so the folks who haven't can see them. Okay, now keep them up. Those of you that have left a job, because if you didn't, you were going to get fired, put up your hands. Look at that. So, my mistakes. First mistake is failure to remember. And failure to remember that this is what pastors know about worship. Now, God bless you pastors that are in this room. And God bless all the pastors out there that actually have spent time studying not only the theological and the practical and the emotional and the marketing aspect of worship. And I know I just lost a bunch of you there. But most pastors learn what they know about worship by going to chapel. So I want to just illustrate some of the mistakes I've made so that you don't make them. So if your pastor goes to, actually this is a bad example. When I wrote this, it was before Willow Creek released the Reveal study, and they took away all my best sermon examples. Do you realize how courageous it was for Willow Creek to say, we got it wrong? It makes me want to go over there and work. Anyway, if your pastor goes to a conference put on by a famous megachurch and comes home and says, I've seen the future of worship and we need to implement it next week, don't do as I do and say, oh, great. If I get it correctly, you're going to stand up in the pulpit and say to everybody in the sanctuary that built this church 50 years ago and some of them are still sitting there, you're going to say to everybody in the sanctuary, thanks for coming, but don't come back because we don't want you anymore. We don't care that you built this church. You're not our target demographic. And in fact, while you're out there and not coming to church, please send us the money because we need it because the people we're going to bring in aren't going to give. And I'm looking forward to the fact I can hire at least 5 more staff plus a totally professional band, and I'm going to put in $40,000 worth of projection equipment and an audio guy plus a screenwriter, a playwright, and an artistic director. I can't wait. Sign me up. And he says, what? That conversation actually happened to me, and he never raised the subject again. Now, why do I tell you that story? Because if you're not conversant with where that pastor just went, if you don't know what's happening, you can't speak on his or her level. And if you aren't passionate about your job and your calling and your ability and your willingness to be teachable and your willingness to adapt, then you'll roll over or get fired. Sorry. I've been telling people all week, you're not going to like what I have to say. I'm sorry. Second thing you need to remember is my mistakes. The second category of my mistakes is failure to understand. If you write anything down, this is it. In every disagreement between you and your pastor, you will lose. I've actually said that in public before and had people come up and say, oh, I just had a disagreement with my pastor. It was big. And, you know, the church was just all in an uproar. And he left. You didn't win. My corollary is, in every public disagreement between you and your pastor, the church loses. And energy that should be spent on kingdom building is being spent on kingdom dividing. And the hard message here, folks, is you either need to work with your pastor, or you need to leave. Because as revolutionaries, you have to shake the dust off of your sandals and go to the next town, go to the next place. Bob Weber's message cannot die because you get burnt out or fried or angry or bitter or resigned because you got fired. This is too big a thing. Way too big a thing. You can change the world. So now in another shameless plug, I'll talk about the magazine. And I just wrote an article in the March-April edition of this year that described 4 models of music and worship ministry. And those models are competition. Competition is obvious. Coexistence is musician on this side of the platform, pastor on that side of the platform. Cooperation and connection. I'm very fortunate now. I have a pastor that I work with. I don't work for, I work with. And the first thing we agreed on before I got there was, I've got his back. He's got my back. And we've had to pull out the lightsabers a few times. I'm reading this book called Blink. Any of you ever read Blink? Malcolm Gladwell? Premise of Blink is that in as little as 2 seconds, human beings have an unconscious ability to make snap decisions about people, situations, and things. And we can actually learn to kind of use it for good. And the concept is called thin slicing. So I want to tell you that I believe that there is hope. I'm not completely pessimistic. In fact, in many ways, I'm optimistic. And I'm optimistic because of you. One of the principles that Gladwell talks about that I want to share with you, and I want to share a real life example, is that people make decisions about the content of something. In this particular case, the case that he was talking about is a product, based upon that 2-second introduction to the package. And the example that he uses is that, everybody know what a 7-Up can looks like? 7-Up in all of its infinite wisdom decided that they would change the can. They added more yellow to the can. They did not change the inside, the drink. They made the can slightly more yellow. Sales immediately plummeted. And they discovered by running it through focus groups is that people felt that they had changed the formula of 7-Up to make it too much lemon. Not consciously, nothing had changed. So I want to tell you a story about worship where I am now. I have to tell you, I'm not a very relational guy. Like Eric Clapton says, I don't do people well. So I was fortunate in the place I am now, where I had a staff. And one of my staff members had been there a long time, and she was a great mother hen, so to speak. And her job in part, although we never really talked about it, was to be out amongst the congregation during fellowship time and listen. And she would report back things that I was doing wrong, or that we were doing wrong, or the fact that we hadn't done holy, 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 even though we had done it the week before, but they weren't there that week, and stuff like that. But she took another position, and we rearranged the situation. We decided not to replace her, but we had to pick up her piece of the pie, so to speak. And this is the kind of relationship that I have with my pastor. He sits me down one day and he says, "Vern, this is what you have to do. This is non-negotiable." I said, "Whatever." He said, "You have to go out. You have to get David to play the prelude, because I would play the prelude because I was the only one able to set the perfect mood for the worship service that we had designed." I mean, you know that, right? "You have to let David play the prelude, and you have to spend the 15 minutes before worship out amongst the congregation in fellowship with them, in the sanctuary or in the fellowship hall. And you must spend we do early service, late service, and there's fellowship time in between. You must spend the whole fellowship time in amongst the congregation." Now, he knows I'm not a relational guy, but he had observed that because I was distant from the congregation, they didn't know me, and therefore they were still not willing to accept me. So I said, "Sure." I said, "But you got to give me one." And he said, "Okay." And I said, "I need 3 minutes before every worship service to stand up in front of the congregation and explain to them why this worship service is designed the way it is, what we're trying to accomplish, and why we hope to meet God here." And he says, "Okay." In 6 weeks, the entire congregation's body language, actual conversation, and their engagement with worship has changed. Are we doing a different worship service? No. It is like somebody lit a fire under these people. All we did was change the packaging. All we did was change the marketing. I know that's hard to hear. So I'll close here pretty quickly, but I want to give you just the last couple things. In this book, Gladwell says that revolutionary change most of the time cannot be adequately evaluated except by professionals in the same field. It gives two examples. First example is New Coke. You remember New Coke? They did focus groups. They tasted it by sipping. And it turns out that Coke doesn't do very well against Pepsi in a sip test. But Coke does very well against Pepsi if you sit at home and drink the whole can. So Coke decided they would create this new product in order to compete with Pepsi, and they built a product that would pass the sip test. Do you remember what happened to New Coke? Is it still on the shelf? Do you remember the hit that Coca-Cola took? Second example he gives is All in the Family. And if you never watched that, I'll give you the other one, which is Mary Tyler Moore. When those shows were put together, they did focus groups, and all the executives at all the networks hated it, both of them. In the case of All in the Family, the only reason it got on TV is because CBS had an open slot and they were desperate. In the case of Mary Tyler Moore, the only reason it got on TV is because by the time they did the focus group test, they already had 13 episodes in the can, and they didn't want to give up on those 13 episodes. Any of you ever watch All in the Family? Anybody ever watch Mary Tyler Moore? In syndication? The sad truth, folks, is no one can evaluate the worship you're doing except one of your peers. And that's a lonely existence. And you need your peers. Don't go out and isolate yourself. Your class, whatever letter you happen to be, is your community. And it will be the rest of your life. And the beauty of IWS is that it's diverse. Your classes are diverse. And you know what I've learned in the last 15 months in business? If you take your network and join it with another network that is diverse, incredible things happen. Second thing is, because you're revolutionaries, you need to preach the gospel. You need to multiply yourselves. You need to help IWS continue this mission. When you go back, tell somebody about IWS. Help them understand why it's absolutely necessary for them to enroll. Because if we change all of worship, the kingdom is glorified. When you get to be my age, you start understanding that life becomes shorter and shorter. Train somebody that can't afford to go to IWS. Mentor them and teach them everything you know. Replace yourself so that you can move on and train somebody else. I promise this is the end. Daryl spoke this morning. Why did I label this? Here's looking at you, kid. Daryl spoke this morning about the new Indiana Jones movie. It made me think about movies. And in one of the most iconic movies ever made, a girl, a scarecrow, a lion, and a tin man went down the yellow brick road, and what were they looking for? Heart, mind, and courage. You will need all three of those when you get back home and you pull the curtain aside and find there's probably a very insecure person back there. I actually have never seen Wizard of Oz all the way through. I never liked it. But my favorite movie in the whole world is Casablanca. In Casablanca, a beaten down cynic who's hiding in a corner of the world never loses his passion for what is right, what is noble, and what is good. And when faced with a crisis, he furthers the cause. That's my charge to you. That's my challenge to you. Trust me, it'll be the beginning of a great friendship. Thank you. I was supposed to leave time for questions, but that never happens when I talk, so.
Now, let me ask you one question that has come to mind as you've been speaking. Do you have any practical advice, particularly in terms, not methods, but particularly in terms of attitudes that music ministers can have towards, particularly towards their pastors and upwards leadership? Just a few nuggets of how we can be servant leaders to our pastors. And then for the pastors who are here, how they can be servant leaders to their congregations. And to the teachers here, how they can be servant leaders to their students when they go back home to their places of employment, or whatever your area of ministry may be, how we can be practically servant leaders to folks that we work with, and sometimes difficult situations.
I think the golden rule applies. If you treat your pastor the way you'd like your pastor to treat you, it will come back to you. I think you need to be proactive in a couple of areas. I think you need to be proactive in your teachability. And for you folks here, that should be a snap. I think you need to be proactive in going in. If you're having problems with your pastor right now, I can tell you something that worked for me. I had a pastor who was so controlling that she said to me and the whole staff in a staff meeting, "You can't send any email out of this building without me seeing a copy of it first." And I said, "Even to my mother?" She said, "Especially to your mother." So I left the staff meeting before I threw something at her. And when I'd calmed down, I went into her office and I said, "I'd like to work with you. I'd like for you to be successful. Obviously, I don't understand what I'm supposed to do. Can you tell me what you'd like from me?" And we started a dialogue. And I wish I could say it was a good dialogue, because within 6 months, I decided to take my severance while I was working, and so I gave 15 months notice. But what she said to me explained her position, and it was clear to me that I wasn't the guy. She needed somebody on the platform who was inferior in influence and stature than her, and I couldn't do that. But in the time that I was still there, I never deliberately upstaged her. I never deliberately antagonized her. I never played to the congregation in front of her. And by the time I left, I went out with my head high. I retired. I didn't get fired. And it's interesting, because since then I've actually encountered her two or three times at things like weddings and stuff like that. And the last time I talked to her, she came up to me and she said, "You know what? I'm really sorry that we couldn't work together." And I said, "You're right," because I'm still processing anger. Does that help?
Yeah. I also want to encourage you to pray for those that you work with, work for every day.
Yes, I'm sorry, I should have said that.
Yeah.
If you're not in prayer, your relationship with somebody that you have trouble with, you've heard this before, like you guys are, you do this more than I do. You know all this, right? You have a difficult relationship and you're not in prayer for that other person, it'll never change. Every time that I've found myself being obedient to God and praying for God's best for the person that I'm having trouble with, God has interceded. So prayer should be number one.